Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schankelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we are talking about questions that are easy to ask, but are hard to answer.
Well, and this is prompted from a question I received a couple days ago, or actually last week, as I'm recording this. And it was one that I've seen over and over in my career, you know, and it was basically scant information about what the circumstance was. And then the question was nicely framed as a separate paragraph, and it even had a question mark at the end of it. And it says, well, how many samples do I need? Okay. Which is an honest question. There's no doubt in my mind that, and I'm sure you have had this, Chris, and people listening to this have probably, you know, getting ready to do something and run an experiment or running a test or whatever, and their boss or their boss's boss or an engineer or somebody they're working with says, well, how many samples are you going to use? How many samples do you need? And usually I found there's an easy answer, which is not helpful, but is sage, I think. Is you're going to need more than you think you do, or something like that, more than you're going to get. But what's your first response to somebody who says, well, how many samples do I need?
Well, it usually comes back, we've covered this topic in many other conversations, but what decision are you trying to inform?
Yeah.
And answering that question won't give you all the information you need to work out how many samples you need. But before I go on that path, an anecdote I have, or a story I have, with people have scant information thrown my way but expect a magnificent, fully researched PhD dissertation in response. I remember this one guy through Ascendo actually asked, said, hey, I'm modeling this pump system. Can you create a Markov chain for me, Markov chain model?
Mm-hmm.
He go, all right. Well, let's just talk about what is this pump, you know, and what's, you know, what states are we talking about? And he just said, oh, it pumps fluid from a tank to somewhere else. Can you do a Markov chain model for me?
It's either on or off, isn't it? I mean, there's a degraded state, I'm sure, or there's a backflow state. It's probably four or five mechanisms in different stages it could be in, but right. Why do you need a Markov model for that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why is it your first guess Markov? And also, for those of you who haven't been involved with Markov chain models, they can be useful at modeling how systems can go from one state to a state of degradation and all the way down to complete failure. But they can also model how you go from a state of degradation back up to a fully functional state through maintenance. So There's a lot to unpack there in about half a sentence worth of information. You just can't do it. But I suppose going back to your question about how do you answer the question, how many samples do I need? You have to start the decision. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to, if you're just trying to choose between two potential materials for your design, then you don't need as many samples because you're just trying to work out which rubber, for example, is better.
Yeah, or which polymer melts at your use temperature. Oh, yeah, that one melts. Let's use the other one.
Right.
<You know? laughs> Yeah, some things are easy, but it's...
Yeah.
But we don't need to get into the details of it. But I mean, that was a question. It was like, if you're going to ask me that kind of a question, are you doing a pass fail test, or are you doing a test where you are measuring time to failure? Is it a test where you can measure degradation? Is it something that's absolutely critical to the survival of your organization, or is it really doesn't matter? You know, where is it on the spectrum of things? You know, beyond, well, what are you trying to do? You know? And if it's a critical and, you know, to the project or the organization, and it's, you know, going to make your design, well, then you're going to need a whole lot more information in order to figure out, well, how many samples do you need? But you only need one that just explodes into a ball of fire to go, well, that's not the right one. Let's try something else.
Right. But, so, you know. Oh, for example, I mean, you talked about pass-fail tests, and that's a really good example of how nuanced that question is. So let's just say you're trying to work out let's pick a tire. A tire is something we all understand. And let's try to say you're trying to work out how long those tires will last in terms of distance before they fail.
Right.
But maybe the question that's being asked is, will this last 40,000 kilometers or 40,000 miles? Yes or no?
Right.
So one approach is getting lots of tires and testing them all for exactly 40,000 miles or kilometers and seeing how many of them fail within that period.
Yeah. That's one approach. If enough of them survive out of, you know, a binomial distribution calculation, and you could figure out whatever, all the details you want, how much risk you're taking and how, you know, the cost of failures and blah, blah, blah. And you could say, I need 22 to survive 40,000 kilometers and I'm good.
Right. But another approach to that test is, instead of just testing for 40,000 miles or 40,000 kilometers and then stopping, is test to failure. So you get a number of tires, and it just to say the first three tires on that test, the first one fails at 92,000 kilometers, the second one fails at 88,000 kilometers, and the third one fails at 89,000 kilometers. Well, those three times to failure, or distance to failure, are twice as long as that 40,000 mile or kilometer interval that interests you. So you've already got a lot of confidence just because these things are so much more reliable than the reliability you're demanding, that you don't need to test as much. And I think it comes, that's what it comes back down to, that that topic we talked about in our previous conversation, confidence.
Yeah.
Confidence is a measure of you, not a measure of the system. How confident do you need to be to make the decision?
Well, there's that. Yeah. And when you get into statistics, and I think part of why we get these, you know, how many samples do I need? And a very simple, short question in modeling and all these other types of questions that are easy to ask, is you need to know enough of, in it. When you mentioned that tires, everybody understands tires, right? No, they're amazingly complex pieces of equipment when you get into it, right? I had a neighbor that worked at a Goodyear plant, and I mean, he was a PhD chemist, and like, what does a chemist do at a tire factory? And he went into adhesives and molding and forming and wear patterns and all. I mean, it's all, for him, it was all chemistry. He was, you know, but it was, when you dive into it, it got really complex real quick. And I think I didn't know, I was naive asking, well, what's so fancy about tires? And well, yeah, there's a lot to it. But the same goes for, you know, statistics. Yeah, there's an easy answer. And then there's more nuanced questions. And starting with what you're trying to accomplish is a good place to start. And then what kind of data you have, and then all kinds of other things. But that's one. So here's a question for you I got from a client once. I'm sitting in this room with a bunch of very smart people. They're all doctor this, doctor that, right? And it was a chemical process that converted sunlight into electricity. And it was liquid state. And so the sun would create a little bit of energy. These molecules would come apart. And that would create an ionization, basically. And it would be a current flow. And when it went further in its process, and it moved a certain amount of distance, it lost enough energy that it would bind back together. It would recombine the same molecules. Said, we really want to be with that oxygen molecule or atom over there, so we're going to go back together.
Right.
And the sun shines on it again, and they separate, and they make electricity. And so their question to me was, and this is the first time I'd seen this product, right? And it's like, we need to prove that it fails. Okay, that sounds easy. Have you had any fail yet? Oh yeah, if you run a tank over it, it crushes it. If you put a nail through it, it leaks. But they want to know how the chemistry fails. And I'm sitting there going, do I need to tell them about the second law of thermodynamics? Do you think they know that already? what happens if it's in full, you know, super sun all the time? Well, it works great. It's like it stays 100% all the time. It just cranks out tons of electricity. Well, what happens if it's dark overnight? Well, in cycles. Well, as soon as it sees the sun for about half an hour, it comes back up to 100%. And they finally offered, says, well, if you put it in a freezer for a week, it's almost completely dead. But you lay it back outside in the sun here in Boston, and it comes right back to 100% within about 3 hours. Contaminants, you know, this or that. And they did all these chemical equations. I mean, they honestly didn't know how to make it fail. And the Army went by it unless they knew how long it would last, other than physical damage. And so they ended up making a completely different formula that would eventually fail. I was like, okay. They put in something that would be a catalyst that would be consumed and it would last 20 years because it really wasn't needed. And they said, when the catalyst is done, then it won't be as good anymore. So we'll call that a failure. But it was a simple question. We need to show how it fails. Can you help us? Well, yeah, sure. No, I have no idea how this thing works.
I think you talked about that example a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. It just blew me away. I'm, you know, it's like, you guys created this product that doesn't fail. Oh, that's clever. Okay. And you know, if you're going to buy this thing, you'd be, well, is it going to work for 2 days or is it going to work for 20 years? And what do I need to do with this? But that was an easy one to ask, but it was a fun project. We tried all kinds of weird stuff to try to make this thing fail. Never did.
Which is a rarity these days. The good thing about law of thermodynamics is it's something that it's a law that physics observes and there's no deviations from it. So essentially the law of thermodynamics, when you're talking about ionization and based on excitation, I'm guessing from UV light or just visible light, it's a beautiful thing when it's that simple.
But it's, I mean, you were adding energy back into the system and any heat generated was basically a byproduct of the sun adding its energy into it and the chemical processes that were occurring. But it was, and it was pretty efficient too, compared to like a solar panel or other types of technology for solar power. But it was just the chemical. Well, anyway, it was beyond me to answer. I mean, I've had another one was like, we have this heart valve. And again, it's a bunch of medical doctors, you know, basically, and all these engineers have been working on heart valves for 20 plus some years. And they're saying, we need to be able to solve the body's rejection of these valves when they get implanted in things. And you're a reliability guy. Can you help us solve that? No. I don't know why the body does what it does when you stick something inside of it. It does what it does. And they had no clue. And they were already doing really nice design of experiments and all kinds of cool stuff. And it was, they were already doing all the stuff I was thinking of that you could do. And that one I couldn't answer. And it was easy to ask, how can we prevent this failure mechanism? And it was calcification. One of the bodies, for some people, their body, if it has a foreign object inside of it, will encase it in calcium and just put a rock around it and isolate it. If it can't eject it, it'll just isolate it. And that's not good for a valve that's supposed to move.
No.
But they had all kinds of ways to make it, you know, all kinds of things they're trying to do to make it work. But that was a tough question. That was why they brought me down there. And like, I really don't know. I don't know. You've had a few interesting questions, and I'm sure.
The other easy question to ask, sometimes we get asked, is why won't this work? You get brought into the same scenario as opposed to, you know, I have never been asked by a company to try and help them work out how it might fail.
Yeah, that was unique. That was definitely cool. Or wait a sec, we got a failure, but is it possible for us to ignore that? Well, of course it's possible for you to ignore it. It doesn't change the reality of what it's telling you.
Yep, survival's not mandatory, so you don't have to adhere to warnings and things like that.
That's right.
But another good one, like I said, is where we get asked what is wrong with this system? Why won't it work?
Yeah.
And you go, well, you tell me. And they say, well, you're the reliability guy. You're supposed to be able to walk in here and tell us with magic and mysticism to why this thing is not no longer working.
Well, let me go do a parts count prediction. That'll tell us.
Right, and a lot of the times it's usually an organization which has just rushed through any semblance of any reliability program, mm-hmm. done the bare minimum, convinced themselves that they've exhausted all their own energies in terms of solving the problem, but really don't want to do things right the first time. And of course, one of the easiest things to do is make the problem seem like it's bigger than it is by getting an external third party involved. That mm-hmm. that automatically ratchets up the importance factor. So that when the CEO says, "Why it's not working?" Well, we don't know. We've got some expert coming in, because that's how novel and how unexpected and how unbelievably rare this particular failure is. So you've got an expert to come in. And you go, "Well, did you actually ever consider reliability during design?" "Oh no, we just have really good engineers."
Really good engineers. Yeah, I've heard that before.
Okay. Well, that's the problem. What are you talking about? Anyway.
Yeah. Now, one question I got was, it was along that lines. They had a big failure, and it was a mechanical engineering. It was a structure with a horizontal beam and a vertical beam, and they had a little two L brackets to bolt them together. Very, very simple design, except they needed to get alignment right. And so they made, instead of putting slots in there to allow for alignment in the structure itself, and so that these clamps or these brackets would fit flush, they just didn't put the brackets flush. So there'd be a half inch to an inch gap between the bracket and the vertical post, and there'd just be two screws or bolts basically kind of going between the two of them. And I'm like, now, and when I first saw it, and I'm looking at him and going, you know, I'm not a mechanical engineer, but that doesn't look right. And I didn't have any background or engineering knowledge other than vague, you know, experience going, that's probably not going to work. And it turned out to be exactly right. And it ended up, they didn't believe me. So he says, "How did you know that?" And I said, "Well, you need to prove it. This is a $1 million problem and all that other stuff. And you can't blame us with this, you know, just your hunch." And I'm like, all right, fine. So I hired a friend of mine that did CAD modeling and finite element analysis modeling, and says, "How much of a gap can this flange have or this bracket have before it? And how much does it reduce its strength?" And he goes, "Oh, you go a quarter inch off of it, it loses almost all of it." Oh, okay, cool. And he did all these fancy models. He charged more than I did for the whole project, but it was like, they wouldn't believe me. I'm like, all right, great. I was blown away by that one.
Yeah, and sometimes it's sort of wear right until you prove I'm wrong sort of approach. And that never does well. So when the topic of this podcast is questions that are easy to ask but hard to answer. So they say, "Well, why isn't this working?" or "Why is that not going to work?" Sometimes it's easy to answer. So, "Well, that's clearly not lining up, and that's that over there." And
this bends too much, and this will crack. It has fatigue, or this will melt, or all kinds of stuff.
And then I go, "Well,
that'll never happen in the field.
I'm not going to believe you until you prove it beyond reasonable doubt." And you go, "Well, okay, so it's easy to ask what's wrong, but it's hard to answer because you're so biased towards the answer you want to hear that until I, again, did that same dissertation level research project to demonstrate how wrong you are just because you haven't thought of it doesn't mean that it could possibly work."
Yeah.
And then they're those sort of clients that you don't really enjoy working with either.
No. Now, I agree with that. I tend to avoid that crowd. But there's others that are, we're adding, the question is complex. It's easy to ask. So we got this failure. It's intermittent, but it's really a problem when it fails and it's costly. So we need to solve it. What's the technique? Can you help us solve this? And then we just come in with the failure analysis process and step through and asking the right questions and sorting it out, running some experiments and so on. It's a complex answer, yet we have tools that they could have, you know, that they could learn from and use themselves going forward. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just using the techniques and the processes and the tools appropriately. And I think that that bias problem is, well, I had a boss like that once. I'm wondering if he was just giving me a hard time and trying to make me work harder or really didn't believe the answers, which I suspect he didn't really believe the answers. We were running an experiment on a factory floor, and we did sample size calculation, did all this cool stuff. And the answer was clear that process A was much, much better than process B. And he looked at the results and read them through and asked a couple of questions about the technique and everything else. And it was, oh, this all looks good. But I don't believe the answers. We'll try again.
Cut.
I want process B to work because we make more money there. And I'm it was basically, and he did this a couple of times. We'll keep testing it until I get the answer I want.
Yeah. That's not how things work. And there's also good examples of that phenomenon where people can, I forget what metrics they are, but let's just say it's the price of corn and cancer rates in Nepal. You can find people spend time going through the internet finding those trends or those statistics which just happen to align. You go, wow, that's amazing. You go, actually, no, it's not amazing, because they had to go through thousands or thousands upon thousands of random phenomena to try and then, with bias, because they're trying to essentially find the trend thereafter, show that this aligns with this other phenomenon over here, which things are
unrelated. There's one in the States that I think it's the who wins the world, or the a baseball game, then becomes president. You know, which party wins the presidency is based on who wins the World Series.
Right.
Okay. That's obviously a causation thing, I'm sure.
Yep. Or those that octopus that picks World Cup winners for soccer/football.
Now there are, yeah, exactly. There is one test that, if you're doing an electronics product, one of the criteria oftentimes is that the FCC, the Federal Communications or Commission or whatever that stands for, is that your product really can't radiate various frequencies because it'll interfere with other things. I think now the 5G rollout of cell phones is running afoul of aircraft that are somewhere close to that frequency. So they're concerned about interference and stuff like this. It's not like they didn't know that this was happening 8 years ago. And so now they're balking at when it's just at rollout. But so there's one test where you EMI, electromagnetic radiation, EMR or whatever. But it's such a finicky, funny phenomena that it's an easy one to ask, do I pass this standard or not? But if you put your hand within an inch of a cable, it'll change the results. If you put the cable to the left a little bit so that it's just got a little more spacing from some other surface, it will change the results. And so there's all kinds of just how do you set this up so that you have enough margin that you'll actually pass it, independent of how the adjudicators are setting up your system. It is a nightmare task if you have something that actually has pretty high frequency and is going to radiate. There's lots of ways to make it more robust, but they all add a lot of cost and complexity to your system.
And you know, there's some simple solutions, especially if that cabling can be routed through certain parts of your system. You can avoid certain areas, so you can choose to have a very sophisticated approach to wiring harnesses and things like that, or just shield everything at the wazoo with thousands of dollars added to the price.
Yeah. Now, and it's, you know, sometimes it's a trade-off with weight or with cost or, I mean, there's always trade-offs in it. And I've been in those labs a number of times where it's basically, it's like my dad when I was growing up. Would you move the antenna to the left a little bit? Oh, right, that's it. And I take my hand off and he loses a picture. Put your hand back there. So I'm standing next to the TV holding the antenna for 20 minutes while he finishes watching the TV show he wanted to watch. Yeah, become part of the antenna system. But there are phenomena and human interactions and all kinds of cool stuff that creates a bevy of questions that are sometimes pure curiosity, and it's an interesting, fascinating question. But like you said a couple of times, we'll take a, you know, a dissertation level set of research for 20 years to solve and to get a clean answer. And others, I think, come from naive. Is that the right word?
Naivety.
Yeah. Not understanding how complex the answer has to be to answer your question, like how many samples do I need? But the good thing out of it is that people do ask questions, and you know,
yep,
that then cracks open that there are ways to go about doing this and solving it and getting answers to these different questions. And sometimes it might not be the right question, and that's a common phenomenon too, but I don't think this rant, it actually was therapeutic for me talking about some of these strange questions I've gotten. But the idea is that if you stop asking questions, you're going to stop moving forward. And I think that's a key part. So it's hopefully comes across as an encouragement to ask questions, you know, stump the consultant, that's fine, but ask the questions.
Well, I think the scenario you talked about at the start where someone asks you, well, how many samples do I need? If that then the person then responds and says, oh, okay, so I need to know this, or I need to do this, or mm-hmm. this is the problem I need to solve, then that person's motivation in asking the question is to solve the problem or make the right decision.
Yep.
Whereas another person could ask exactly the same question, which is how many samples I need, and say, well, you need to know this, need to know this, or what, or just elaborate in the context. But they keep coming back to you and say, just give me the number. They're after a number.
Yeah.
So both people are asking the same question, but it's all about what it is they're trying to achieve. And the person who asks the first question, who's trying to solve a problem, that first question then starts a whole series of questions and learning, which is all you can ask for.
Yep.
But if people just want to ask simple questions and not truly solve the problem or make the right decision or do whatever it is they're supposed to be doing, then we can't help you.
That's right. Yeah. No, I have a standard answer for people like that. You know, 42. You need 40. Where does that come from? So it comes from a book.
Yep. Meaning of life.
Go away. So anyway, cool. If you're listening to this and have a question that you'd like us to tackle, hopefully it's easy. Not the question, but the answer. Let us know. If you've got a question that is, you know, you've had a good story around or something like that, let us know. We'd like to get that as part of a future show. But if you got a question, let us know. And you can do that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you'll find a widget to record a voice message, and or you could write us a comment or your question there. Or you could find Chris or I or the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn or on our About pages. Plenty of ways for you to join the conversation. And we look forward to hearing from you.
So,
all right. Well, thanks, Chris. Let's go see what's flooding our inboxes today with interesting questions.
Absolutely, Fred. Okay. Well, until next time.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.